Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So today, Melanie, as you know, the Patriots started their season playing against the Dolphins, and the kids all were watching with me, and we were much amused that one of the Dolphins players is named Waddle, which isn't just, we're not just making fun of his name. Waddle is actually the name of, was it Sophie's?
Sophie's favorite penguin.
Favorite stuffed penguin toy is named Waddle.
Yes. Waddle the penguin has gone on many adventures. Waddle the penguin has been, in his time, a spaceship pilot. Uh-huh. And his spaceship has gone to places like the moon and Mars and other planets.
But he's apparently also a Time Lord because it's a space and time ship.
Yes. Waddle has also been an archaeologist. I remember there was an adventure in which our Waddle was digging up dinosaurs and resurrecting them and then using them to fight the Nazis, which was my favorite Waddle adventure ever.
Which is a really good story, which someone should actually write up. The Nazi fighting penguin.
But it's interesting, like as homeschoolers, you find the frequently the game, at least my kids, the games that they play are frequently have reflections of what we've been studying in school. So you can kind of see the little bits and pieces of like the kids' interests and fascinations and the things that they've picked up from their school lessons coming out in the stuffed animal games.
Mm-hmm.
And Waddle has been a great sort of protagonist in adventures, which, yeah, near and far, back to the future. And Waddle periodically gets lost, as many stuffed animals do. But whenever Waddle gets lost, it's because Waddle has been on an adventure. Yep. He's probably time traveled. Waddle does have something up on Doctor Who, though.
Which is?
The Doctor has a spaceship shaped like a phone booth, right?
Right.
But Waddle has a device that he can wear on your wrist that will take you,
oh, you mean
through time and place.
Like
Captain Jack?
Captain Jack. And also, what's her name? River Song.
Yes.
She also has one. But they're dangerous. It's dirty time travel, as the Doctor says. It's very dangerous.
Yes. Well, yeah. Evidently that's the kind that Waddle likes, dirty and dangerous.
Well, apparently Waddle is, in addition to all those other things, is now a professional football player with the Miami Dolphins. So.
You know, it doesn't surprise me because Waddle the Penguin does get around.
Yes.
And I'm sure he's like somehow figured out how to trick everybody into thinking that he's a human being so that he can play football.
Yes, yes, I'm sure. So that amusement aside, let's talk about what we've been doing. So as we promised last week, I think we did mention we were going to go apple picking.
And we did.
And we did. We picked one of the best days of the year. I mean, this was a gorgeous day, not a cloud in the sky, you know, mid-70s.
Not too cold, not too hot.
Yeah. And we went on Friday because we're trying to avoid the, like, every apple orchard in New England on a Saturday or a Sunday, especially if the weather's good, which it has been, is insane full of people, as we've experienced.
Yeah.
So we try to go during the week, and we went Friday because that's when I could finish up my work and go. And so we thought we'd have the place to ourselves. We didn't exactly, but it was fine.
It wasn't crowded, but
there were three school buses full of teenage girls from some girls' school that were there. Like I said, it was fine. There was a bit of an issue with some other families that were there with their kids were kind of wild and out of control in the play area. And our kids were not happy. Our three youngest ones were not happy with the other way the other kids were playing. They were a little rough. But yeah. But we went to Berlin Orchards, which is in Berlin, Mass. And this is the place where we go every year now. We've been to a number of different places over the years. And the kids were talking about that, the different places we've been. But we've settled on this place partly because it's a family owned by a family that we've met that are a very Catholic family. They have seven I forget how many kids. They have a whole passel of kids who are all working the orchard. When you go, you meet all the kids. And it's just really good. He's from Ireland, but I don't think his wife is. But he's originally from Ireland. And they're just a great family and a great orchard. And it's a lot of fun. It's huge. They keep expanding it. They keep growing more trees.
Yes.
And this summer, because of both the heat and the extra rain, it's a real bumper crop. I mean, those trees were packed.
I've never seen them that loaded with apples.
Yeah, it was wild. So when we got there, we took the van out. While we were in the van, we were listening to a new
audiobook.
The new Swallows and Amazons series audiobook. Which one is it?
The Big Six.
The Big Six. This takes us back to the Norfolk Broads.
Yes.
Which I'm pleased with, because I've actually been following a YouTube channel from a guy named Simon. The channel is Simon Bloke in the Woods, who lives in the Broads and does a lot of camping and canoeing in that area. So I've become familiar with the visuals of that area, of the outdoorsy parts. So it's kind of fun to see that. And so we listened to that on the way out. And yeah, when you get there, you get on a wagon pulled by a tractor, and you ride the wagon out to the orchard, and you hike in, and the first thing you do is you grab an apple and you eat it.
Absolutely, the first thing.
There's nothing like eating an apple off the
tree. Also, Berlin, the tractor ride is free. It's not.
Oh yeah,
you don't pay extra. We've been to orchards where you paid extra for every single thing. You paid extra for the petting zoo, and you paid extra for the tractor ride, and you paid extra for the
right. There's a place in, I think it's Wellesley, Belkin Lookout Farms. It might have changed hands. It might be some other name, Lookout Farms, but it is the Disney World of apple orchards in this area. I mean, it is like, it is an operation. It is huge. It's like, it's the place that when people don't want to go all the way out past 495, Route 495. They want to, go to apple picking from the city, someplace relatively close. They go there. I mean, it, like you said, it's wicked expensive. Like, you buy a small bag or a big bag. And like, I think, so at Berlin, the big bag was $35. The small bags were 30, were, I
25.
I think, at look, Belkin.
Oh, at Belkin.
The last time we went was probably 10 years ago to Belkin.
Uh-huh.
That was, I think then the small bags were like $30. And then, yeah, there's a petting zoo and there's all this other stuff, which is fine, but it's all extra and expensive. And it feels like a big operation. I don't know. Right.
Berlin also has animals that you can pet. They have donkeys and sheep and pigs and
all the right animals for a nativity scene, which they do in the winter, in Advent, they do a living nativity, being a Catholic family and with a lot of kids. So they do a living nativity every year too. So yes, they have animals that you can feed and pet and whatnot. And of course, as we mentioned, I think we talked about this before, they have apple cider donuts.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently not everyone has ever had an apple cider donut.
Apple cider donuts are pretty much a New England thing as far as I can tell.
My gosh.
I don't think I'd ever had one before I moved here.
We're going to be talking about apple cider donuts in a bit, in a different form. But they had apple cider donuts, and it's just so, for one thing, they're fresh.
So an apple cider donut is a cake donut, not a yeasty donut.
Right.
But it's made with apple cider in the batter.
Right.
And then it's usually coated with cinnamon sugar on the outside.
And it uses apple pie spices.
Yes. It's like the cinnamon and
Clove, and I'm trying to think of the other ones that are in apple pie spice. But whatever the apple pie spices are, there's some of that in there. And then, yes, and it's coated in a cinnamon sugar. The best ones are.
Yeah. And when you get them fresh, and most of the orchards, you do get them fresh because they're selling them quickly enough that they don't sit around.
Right.
They're so good.
And they're nowhere as near as good the next day.
No.
And, you can go to Dunkin' Donuts and get apple cider donut.
It's not the same thing.
They sell them. They have it from Entenmann's in the boxes. Uh-huh. I don't know what that is. That ain't no apple cider donut. But
no.
It tastes vaguely like apple. But we got some apple cider donuts. We got some kettle corn. It was like a feast. And we brought out our sandwich lunches. So we had sandwiches there. We didn't stop at McDonald's on the way home like we have in the past. And every time we go to a McDonald's, it's $50 right there.
Right.
Easy. I mean, it's the seven of us. There's just no way around it. So, yeah, I'd much prefer to bring a sandwich, sit outside. It's nice. Beautiful day, like I said. So they have peach trees, but we were too late for the peaches.
Yeah, peaches are summer.
Yeah,
not fall.
And I think they do pears, but though I think their pears weren't ready. So what they had were Galas, Cortlands,
and Ginger Golds,
and Paula Reds.
Right.
So we missed Honeycrisp. I think Honeycrisp are not in yet. We might go to another orchard that's closer to us when the Honeycrisps come in, I think. Because I want to get some of those.
I love Honeycrisps.
Those, yeah, they're the best. So, yeah, apple picking. It's about an hour's drive. That's the only thing. It takes about an hour to get there and an hour to get back. So it's a whole day thing. So, but there are orchards that are closer to us, which would be easier to go to and just grab some apples there. So that was Friday. On Saturday, you had a thing that you were doing with the kids.
Yeah, our local library had advertised that they were having a guy to come in and teach about the ukulele. And I thought that was cool. A friend of ours, Miss Zena, thank you, Zena, had given us a ukulele for the kids to play around with a couple years ago. And they like to pull it out occasionally and strum, but they don't really know how to play it. And so I thought this would be kind of a fun opportunity for them to like learn a bit more about the ukulele. And indeed it was. This guy brought something like 20 ukuleles with him. It was an impressive number of ukuleles.
This isn't a hobby. This is an obsession.
Oh, yeah. So he had plenty. Like they had sign up for like 20 people. And he had at least one ukulele per person, but he actually had enough that everybody could pick up a couple different ones and try them out.
And we brought our ukulele.
We brought our ukulele, which he very, very kindly tuned for us because it was badly out of tune. So I was very appreciative of that. Yeah, it was great. He taught the kids a couple of he did a little bit of a history of the ukulele, and then he taught them some basic chords and some strumming techniques, and you know how to hold it and that sort of thing. There were several older women there who I think they all played guitar at least to some degree or other. They got a lot further with the ukulele lessons because, you know, they had some basic familiarity with chords and stuff.
Right.
So the kids all kind of tired and wandered away before the end. I don't think any kids were left at the end. And it was just like these four older women who were playing. But it was nice. I mean, the kids enjoyed it. And Sophie was very excited because one of the assistant librarians who sat in for the lesson was also left-handed, and one of the other older ladies was left-handed, and so Sophie felt like she was not the only lefty.
Right.
Which...
So to speak.
And which was fun, because she was originally not planning to go, and sort of went reluctantly under protest, and then brought her iPad and was steadfastly drawing throughout, and I grabbed her a ukulele when he invited everybody to grab one, and she just kind of let it sit on her lap, like, I am not touching this thing. But then once we actually started getting into the lesson, and especially once the woman was talking about like how to hold it left-handed, then Sophie was like suddenly, oh, I can kind of look at her and see what she's doing, and she got a little bit more into it, and it was kind of fun.
Good, good.
Got her out of her shell a bit.
Excellent. So I have not heard much ukulele playing since you came back.
Lucy did take the ukulele out to play, but she took it out onto the patio because there were some strenuous objections to too much ukulele playing in the house.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So I'm glad she had some fun with it. So that's what we've been doing. I don't want to talk about the plumbing. Plumbing continues to be an issue. Firewall that. We'll talk about that some other time. Let's talk about what we've been cooking and eating. So one of the things I pulled from the latest issue of Cook's Country magazine this past month was a recipe for something called ranch fried pork chops. You were dubious about this.
I was dubious.
Because ranch dressing has dill. It's a strong flavor of dill. Well, not a strong flavor of dill, but it has dill. And you and I both do not like dill.
I was a little bit surprised that you wanted to, that you had bought dill. I found it in the drawer and I said,
what is this doing here? Who has brought this nasty thing into my house?
Why did you buy dill?
So the thing is I don't like dill as a primary flavoring, but I do like dill pickles. I like ranch dressing. So I said, let's give it a try. So the trick is that they wanted you to have bone-in pork chops. And I don't usually buy bone-in. I like to buy the tenderloin, center cut. I just like the way you brine them so that it gives them a little more flavor and you know, juiciness, and then grill them, and they're great. But I think for cooking inside, like in the on the stove or in the oven, the blade ones might be a little more flavorful. I'm not sure. The blade ones makes it harder to eat. The kids don't like the ones with the bone. Not the blade, the bone-in ones. They don't like those because they it's hard to eat. But this one called for bone-in. So I had two different kinds because that's what they had at the grocery store. They had some thick, very thick ones that were on sale, and they had some thinner ones.
In retrospect, the thinner ones were a better choice.
Yes. The thicker ones just took too long to cook. So the way the recipe works is you don't actually use ranch dressing at all. You're basically replicating the flavors of ranch dressing in the chops, in the coating.
And honestly, I think it was better for the lack of ranch dressing.
Oh, yeah. It would have been gross if you tried to do it with ranch dressing. So the thing, so what you do is you make it's almost like making fried chicken. So you take buttermilk, you mix it with dill, chives, cilantro, and salt, and then you brine the chops in the buttermilk. And that's the other problem is I didn't leave enough time to do this all properly. I didn't look at the timing. I sometimes forget to look at how long the steps are supposed to take. And this is like, brine it for at least 30 minutes, but up to 24 hours. And I had like 15 minutes because I think we had scouts or something that night. So it was fine though. It worked out. And then you make a coating of flour, more dill, more chives, more cilantro, baking powder, garlic powder, salt and pepper, and a little bit of cayenne. Although I left the cayenne out because our kids are sensitive to it.
I would have left the cayenne out.
Oh wait, no, I put cayenne. I did find the cayenne and put it in, but I put less than the recommended amount.
Right.
Okay. And then the interesting thing with the coating is you work it. But you put some of the brine in it, to moisten it, and you work it till it's kind of craggy.
Uh huh.
And then you coat the chops in the coating, from the brine. And then you let them sit so that it adheres. And then you cook them in the, you fry them in a skillet with some oil. And that was enough for some of them. Some of the ribs cooked perfectly well there. Some of them just were so thick.
The chops.
What did I say?
Ribs.
Sorry, that's a little slip because I'm going to talk about ribs in a second. Some of the chops were done just as the recipe says. But the thick ones, I had to end up putting them in the oven to bake.
And that kind of destroyed the coating a bit.
A little bit. But they weren't done in the frying pan. So if I were to do this again, I wouldn't worry about the blade, about the bone. It's their blade chops, like pork chops. I would not worry about the bone. I would get either boneless pork chops or I think chicken breasts or chicken thighs.
The thought about the recipe was that if you took chicken breasts and you sliced them in half,
you cutleted them,
and then you beat them thin.
I don't know that I would beat them too thin because that would dry them out. They would cook way too quick. Like when we do the what's the one with the pork, the
schnitzel.
Sometimes if they're too thin and they get dried up, they're a little tough.
I don't agree.
So it would depend on how thin you want them to be, but I would want them to be at least have a little thickness because chicken will cook a lot faster than the pork will, for one thing. And it also depends on whether they're fully defrosted all the way through. That's another big thing, that these chops, the big thick ones, were not fully defrosted all the way through when I started. I just didn't have time. So, yeah, but I would feel okay doing them without the bone. I'm not sure why they preferred the bone.
I don't understand the obsession.
I would have to read the article that I came with. But in the end, the flavor was good.
I did like the flavor a lot. The breading was really nice. Where it was crispy, it was really good. There were places where it was less crispy, and that was not as good. And I really didn't like the thickness of the thick chops. I wanted more breading to meat ratio.
Yeah, it was clearly better with thinner chops.
Yeah.
So speaking of ribs, as it was, I did make ribs on Saturday again. I've talked about making pork ribs in the past, smoking them. I did something a little different. Cooks has come up with, I talk about Cooks all the time because I like their recipes. The two places I get recipes from the most are Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country and their various properties and Milk Tree Kitchen. But Cooks has recommended a new method of cooking, of smoking ribs, which is, if you have a Weber grill and you don't have an actual smoker, you put 40 briquettes in a C formation around the interior, and then you place wood on it every few. And then, so I tried to do that new method. It ended up not making it as fall off the bone as their older recipe did.
Yeah, it was okay, but it wasn't great.
So I'm going to go, but I did use a different rub this time, the Meatheads Memphis Dust Rub. I like the rub. That's really good. But I'm going to go back to using the older method on the Weber to grill those, because it's 2 hours on the grill and then 2 hours in the oven. And I think that makes them fall off the bone tender.
Yeah, I prefer my ribs to be more tender and less chewy.
Yes. So the other thing we made was, as I mentioned with the apple cider donuts, we made a cake. You made a cake.
Yeah, a friend shared a recipe for an apple cider donut cake. And honestly, it was okay, but it was started with a cake mix and you added cider to it. Like, instead of mixing it with the eggs and everything, you added cider and applesauce to it and some cinnamon and spices. It was okay. I think that next time I might just find an apple cake and make it in a bundt pan and put cinnamon sugar on the outside of it and just like skip the cake mix.
I think the white cake mix consistency is way too, it's like way too consistent, like way too same. What am I trying to say? It's not crumbly enough. It doesn't have enough texture. Like the store-bought Duncan Hines white cake mix. And so I think it would be better to have like a homemade.
Like a crumb.
Yes, the crumb. Something with a little more like a donut-y consistency. I think that would have worked much better.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it was fine. It was just not.
I love the idea.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as it could have been, and I will try to make it again, but tweak it.
Yes, this is what we do. We remake and we tweak.
But today I made apple pie, and my apple pie was
awesome. Fire.
So I mean, I cheap out. I use the pie crust from the freezer.
The pre-made pie crust.
Pre-made. Yeah. I like to get the ones that aren't already in the pack. Like, they're not in the pie plate.
It's not in a pan, yeah.
You roll them out and use your own pan. I don't know why, but I just think that those come out consistently with a better texture.
Well, they haven't been mechanically pushed into an aluminum pan. Right. I think that's a big difference.
And I like to, butter the pan before I put the crust in, which I think gives the crust a little bit more of that buttery flavor. But I made into a lattice top, which you can do with the pre-made things. And
using the apples that we got at the orchard.
Yeah, used the apples from the orchard. So fresh picked apples. And I followed the joy of cooking apple pie recipe. But I added a little bit of nutmeg and cloves to it, which I think is better than just plain cinnamon. And I added the lemon zest as well as the tablespoon of lemon juice. And I just love the pop that lemon zest gives you.
It doesn't make it taste lemony. It just makes it taste more.
It's just richer.
Yeah.
Brighter flavor.
I'm surprised that they don't have cloves and nutmeg. That was another one of those apple spice spices that I couldn't remember. that they wouldn't have those in addition to cinnamon, that it would be just cinnamon.
Yeah, it was just cinnamon. It was kind of odd.
That is kind of odd.
But yeah, it was, it came out really well, and we served it with vanilla ice cream, you know, a la mode, which I never do. I never remember to get the ice cream at the same time I make pie, but today I did.
Today
I
was, we had to go to CVS after mass, so.
I was proud of myself. I saw that they had vanilla ice cream in the case, and I said, ooh, I'm going to buy vanilla ice cream and make
a pie.
Make apple pie with vanilla ice cream.
So the last thing I want to talk about making is I made a clam and fish chowder on Friday. You had found a fish chowder recipe from Simply Recipes.
Right. I basically wanted to improvise, but I just wanted to have some sort of a baseline to kind of.
And I had looked at a cook's.
Inspire me a bit.
Yeah. Clam chowder recipe. And so I basically followed the Simply Recipes fish chowder recipe with differences. And so it has like, you know, olive oil, 1 tablespoon of olive oil and 1 tablespoon of butter to start. And I'm like, that is not nearly enough butter. So
not nearly enough butter.
I mean, so I added more butter at the end, but then onions, white wine, which I thought was good. It says it's optional. Not to me.
No, wine is not optional.
Yeah. The Yukon Gold potatoes cut up small, cooking them ahead of time before you put everything else in, you're cooking them in the butter and oil was a really great thing because that was a lot of times with the chowder, you end up waiting for the potatoes to cook. I usually
pre-cook them in the microwave.
You can do that. I've seen recipes that do that. Now, this called for 2 cups of clam juice. I had picked up a couple of small bottles of clam juice at the supermarket, and I bought 2 different cans of whole baby clams and minced clams. So 2 different things, 2 different textures. And I also had the fish that, so whenever we make fish, like usually, so we usually have halibut and not halibut.
Salmon and haddock.
Haddock, not halibut. We usually have salmon and haddock when we have fish and we don't always eat it all. Usually we eat all the salmon, but sometimes there's a little bit left, but there usually is quite a bit of haddock left. So we put that in the freezer and we save that for this sort of thing, or fish cakes, whatever. So I had that. I also took one of those fillets of haddock that are in there.
Uh-huh.
I used some of that.
Okay. Frankly, there was way too much fish.
There was too much fish, yes.
It could have had less fish, and it would have been better, I think.
I could have put half as much. I put the recipe calls for 1.5 to 2 pounds of fish. I probably went over 2 pounds, I think.
Yeah.
But
I think less is more in terms of when with regards to fish.
Right. And it's like they call for cod or other firm white fish. Haddock is not a firm white fish, so it tends to fall apart anyway.
Yeah.
So it tends to disintegrate a little bit. So there was that. So it calls for Old Bay. But because we had the haddock had the shawarma seasoning on it, I'm like, that is enough spice to compensate for the Old Bay. And then it's like 1.5 cups of heavy cream, and I put the whole 2 cups of heavy cream in.
Oh, yeah. Always just all the cream.
Then I added more milk because I just didn't feel like it was enough liquid in it. So I added more milk. And at the end, so then you let it simmer and all this sort of stuff. At the end, I added more butter, but I also added some Wondra, which is a new discovery for me, which is it's basically super fine flour for thickening. I wanted to thicken it up a little more. I should have put it in on the onions at the very beginning. That would be a better place to give it as a thickener. But I don't know if it made any difference at the end. But it was pretty good. And then, of course, it was leftovers, so I had some yesterday and today at lunch. And it was good. Chowder is always better the next day and the day after. It's one of those things where the flavors get better over time until it's not any good anymore.
At which point stop eating.
At which point throw it away or have finished it. So that's what. So this was a lot of different cooking this week. So I'm kind of pleased that we were able to get a lot of different things. I mean, we made other things too, but.
It's that time of year when it's a little bit cooler and suddenly cooking doesn't seem quite so onerous anymore.
And there's a new bounty of things to cook. I mean, that's the other part of it is there's new things as, you know, the apples and this, you know, squashes and pumpkins and leeks that are still in the fridge.
Yeah, I need to make soup with the leeks. If I'd made the chowder, I'd probably have thrown the leeks in.
If I thought about it, I would have thrown the leeks in too. So let's move on to what we've been reading and reading and watching. So
I am still reading Years of Rice and Salt.
It's been years of Rice and Salt, it seems like.
And it's really good. It's just, it's a big novel.
It is a big novel. It covers literally world history for, what, 700 years? 500 years?
It's kind of hard to tell because the timelines don't really match up and they're using different numbering systems. Like, in fact...
probably doing it on purpose.
Well, and in fact, like, they just decided to redo the numbering system. Like, the scientists have decided that they need a, like, unified dating system.
Mm-hmm.
Because up to this point, they've been using either the Arabic numbering system, which is, like, after Muhammad, and the Chinese numbering system for years, and a whole bunch of other things. Like,
because to remind people, this book is about what if the Great Plague in Europe didn't wipe out 25% of the population, but wiped out 99%. And therefore, most Christians died, and all of those Christian European nations had no real influence on the development of culture from that point on,
right,
around the world. So it was mainly the Chinese and Muslim countries.
Right. I got to the point where they fought a world war. It was basically between the Chinese and the Muslims, and the Indians and the Native Americans ended up siding with the Chinese. It could have gone either way, but they decided sort of at the moment that the Muslims were a greater threat.
Well, you said Indians and Native Americans. You mean like subcontinent of India people?
Yes.
And Native Americans.
In this universe, the Indians from India actually were the first to develop like the steam engine, railroads, etc. And so they had actually conquered quite a bit of the previously Muslim world, but then the Muslims had ended up pushing back. And so there was sort of this back and forth.
I mean, it sounds fascinating. I mean, I love the thought experiment.
It is. And I feel like a lot of the characters, I really have liked a lot of the characters. There's some really great people and I enjoy spending time with them. But I feel like the structure of the novel kind of ends up cutting everybody's life a little bit short so that there's not a full character arc for each person. They're more like vignettes.
Yeah. Well,
very long, very long vignettes, but vignettes with kind of a common theme that runs through. So it's a little bit tantalizing, a little bit frustrating, but I can't put it down.
If you're going to cover 500, 600, 700 years of history, you've got...
Right, yeah. So it's like, it's almost like sort of standing atop the stream and then occasionally dipping your toes in and like sort of testing the waters in a particular place and time. I was really fascinated by the sort of after the Great War, the story focused on a Muslim woman in Europe, Muslim Europe, and who's like becomes an archaeologist and her aunt is a nuclear physicist who discovers like basically the secret of nuclear fission. And they decide, the scientists sort of agree not to build the bomb.
I think we talked about this last week.
Did I?
I think you mentioned that the French woman in Muslim France or the woman in Muslim France discovers the bomb.
I feel like I just read that a couple of days ago.
Or maybe you told me that.
I think I told you about it.
Okay.
Anyway, it's very compelling storytelling. So if you're looking for a nice, big, fat read of alternate and you like alternate history, I recommend it.
So watching TV watching has been dominated this week partly by the anniversary of 9/11. I watched a couple different documentaries. The first one I watched was on Apple TV Plus called 9/11 Inside the President's War Room. And it follows what happened with President Bush on that day mainly. And it was fascinating because they got interviews with all the major players. They had the president. They had Andy Carr, the chief of staff. They had Condoleezza Rice, who was the national security advisor. Cheney, the vice president. I mean, they had everybody. They had the Secret Service agents. They had the pilot of Air Force One. All down the line. And it was a fascinating look at, and they also had photos and video from inside Air Force One, inside the various bunkers where they went. Yeah, it was really good. And it really brought home, you know, how the president had to struggle and how much the government in the beginnings of these events struggle to figure out what's going on, you know, what getting information together, what happened, what's happening now? How do we get a handle on it? You know, even the U.S. government has to deal with that sort of thing in the beginnings of these crises, and how unprepared our our government kind of was before 9/11, you know, this sort of crisis. So it was fascinating. In fact, a little personal anecdote, I used to work with the guy who was the IT director at the White House in the Bush administration. And he told me that one of the big frustrations on 9/11 was that the president could not address the nation from on board Air Force One. There was no facility for the president to get on TV.
Interesting.
Which is why they had to keep landing at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, off at Air Force Base in Nebraska. They wouldn't let him go back to Washington. He wanted to go back to Washington. They wouldn't let him go. And so he had to land and then address the nation.
Right.
So this guy helped develop a new system for use on Air Force One. It's basically, it was a camera rig that clamped onto a chair at one end of the conference room table on board, so that then could feed into the onboard communication systems, and the president could transmit to address the nation from aboard Air Force One. Pretty wild. I'm sure in the intervening 20 years, they've got something much more sophisticated than that. But it was fascinating. So that was really good. So 9/11 inside the president's war room. Totally recommend that. The other one I watched was called 26th Street Garage. That was on Paramount Plus. I don't know if it's available otherwise. But this one tells the story of the FBI's New York City office, which was just down the street, how they had to abandon their building because they weren't sure whether it was a target.
Right.
And so they found this garage on 26th Street where they basically emptied it out. And they moved in and created this FBI field office. And it kind of told the story of how they went about investigating. It was the story of the investigation itself.
And interesting.
Yeah, it was a really interesting story about how they, you know, gathered the data, how they made the connections. And they had an FBI agent in Yemen, and they had this guy here. And, you know, like all the stuff we know about what happened had to be gathered by people running down tens of thousands of little bits of information and compiling it together into a complete picture of this is what happened and these are who's responsible. This is how they did it. I mean, it's amazing. It was a great piece of work on their part. One of the best parts is on the upper floors of that building was where Martha Stewart had her studios.
Uh-huh.
So she would, you know, bring down food cooked in her kitchens for all the FBI agents. And it was a multi-agency task force. There was like 9 agencies, state and federal and local agencies.
They were basically catered by Martha Stewart?
Yes, she was catering their
that's kind of wild.
For a lot of their stuff. Not every meal, but, you know, she was bringing down a lot of food for them.
That was nice of her.
Yeah, so those two were really good. I recommend those. I also watched on Netflix, there's a new limited series called Countdown, Inspiration for Mission to Space. And this is the thing they're doing with SpaceX. This week, I think it's this week, I forget what the exact date is, but this week, SpaceX is launching the first all-civilian astronaut mission to space, which is that none of the people on board have been government employees, either as military or civilian government employees.
So are not now and have never been.
Exactly. Yeah, none of them have served in the military, even, I don't think. So it's an inspirational mission. The idea is they're going to send them up, 4 people, for three days orbiting outside the orbit of the ISS, which is way above the normal orbiting of a manned mission. Because they're really pushing to see, we're trying to go to Mars. We're trying to go to Mars. See, we can do this. We don't have to be a government trip. This is just SpaceX putting this on. The guy who's the leader, the mission commander, is a guy named Jared, something or other, who owns, he's a younger guy, you know, 38, 39, who owns this finance company. He's a billionaire. He's also a bit of a daredevil. He flies, you know, jets and climbs Mount Everest, that sort of guy, right? And so he's the mission leader. One of the things they're doing is they're raising money for St. Jude's Children's Hospital.
Uh-huh.
They're using the publicity to raise money. And so one of the seats is being taken up by a young woman she's 29. She's a physician's assistant at St. Jude's, who also is a former patient. As a child, she had childhood osteosarcoma, bone cancer.
Uh-huh.
And she also has a prosthetic because of it. And so she's going. She'll be the first cancer survivor, first prosthetic wearer, first, the youngest person in space.
Wow.
And like, she totally had, like, when she came into this, she was like, so like naive about, like, she's like, so are we going to the moon? Is that what we're doing? Like, no, we're not going to the moon. Her brother's an aerospace engineer. And he's like, he's on the phone with him and he's like, no, you're not going to the moon. You're going to orbit. Like, she was clueless. And then another one is a woman who's a doctor, scientist of some sort, who had previously applied to NASA and just missed selection. So this is
interesting.
And her dad worked for NASA at one of the tracking stations.
So this is sort of her second chance.
Yes. And then the fourth is this guy from the Seattle area who saw the Super Bowl commercial and entered the contest to win a seat.
No way.
He's like me. He's just like a guy. He's like a dad. He's like a dad who won a trip. And I find his story to be, the most fascinating because it's the most like me.
Uh-huh.
Partly because his wife is like, it's his dream. I'm not going to get in the way of it. I'm not going to say he shouldn't go, but I'm not excited about this. Like, she reminds me of like how you would be. She's like, I'm here. I'm supportive. I'm very worried and concerned that you're doing this very dangerous thing.
Yeah, that sounds like about right.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, as I was watching this, I'm like, why didn't I enter this contest? Like, if this is the sort of thing, like, my dream from when I was a kid was to be an astronaut. Like, I would have leapt at this. And I think I remember now when this commercial aired, I looked at it and said, I can't go because I would not pass the heart, the diabetes, like all that sort of stuff. There's no way that they would send me up in the rocket. It would be too dangerous. I could have a heart attack going up, you know?
Right.
So, but man, that would have been cool.
Prudence won out.
I guess so. Stupid Prudence. I mean, not that I would have won, but I'm watching this, imagining if there were me being interviewed for this, like what that would have been like for us to do this, how cool it would have been to be doing it. I mean, that would be amazing. And so they're going to be up there for 3 days. This isn't just a up, you know, to barely the edge of what some people might call space and come back down again, like some other billionaires have done. This is going out beyond the orbit of the ISS for 3 days, and it's going up this week, I think. So pretty kind of cool.
Interesting. I'm surprised. Like, I haven't really heard anything about
there,
this.
There hasn't been enough. Like, I don't know why there's not more media coverage of this. This is a huge deal. I mean, I'm sure there will be this week as things, you know, 9/11 has passed us. And as this as it gets closer, I think the media might start covering it more. I would hope. Yeah, it is weird. So the last thing I watched last night was this movie on Amazon Prime called Jolt. There was a movie a few years ago starring Jason Statham where it was called Crank, I think. I literally could watch like 25 minutes of it and I had to turn it off. If that. It just was not good. And it was about, he was, I don't know, assassin or gangster or something, I don't know. And someone shot him full of this drug that if his heart rate dropped below a certain amount, like to a resting heart rate, he would die. So he had to keep his heart rate up. And so he would do things like, you know, get into fights and drive fast and electrocute himself and all these other things to keep his heart going fast.
That seems like a really stupid premise.
While he sought out his killer, like the person who tried to kill him. Yeah, it was kind of a dumb premise.
So he couldn't sleep at all then?
Yes. So.
Were you insane because of lack of sleep?
Well, no, he had 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was not like long term. So. That's all precursor. This movie is kind of ripping that off, except it's now a woman and she's a, it's not that she's going to die if she doesn't, get the heart rate up.
Uh-huh.
She has a mental illness of, what is it? Something like a violence, like lack of impulse control with violence. And, ever since she was a kid. And so this psychologist or psychiatrist has hooked her up with this. The one thing that works, no medications don't work, sedatives don't work. The one thing that really works is this harness that she wears that she can send herself an electrical jolt. So it's basically electroconvulsive therapy on the go.
Okay.
And so when she starts to get the impulse to harm other people, she gives herself a little electric shock. And so, and the not to spoil it, but it's not the big deal. It's kind of like a cross between Crank and John Wick. It's very violent, totally unbelievable.
Uh-huh.
And so she has to solve this crime by tracking down the bad guys and getting to the root of things. And I mean, Kate Beckinsale was good. She was good in it. She's, you know, I thought she did a good job. I don't know. The writing, the premise was kind of blah. So, but you know, if you like John Wick or that sort of thing, you might like that. So you said you didn't watch very much this week.
No, I don't think I really did. I watched The Bad Batch today with the kids and Mysterious Benedict Society, and wow, Bad Batch is good.
I feel like
they've really hit their storytelling stride.
Right.
This
isn't just like if you like Star Wars and cartoons, you'll like this. This is real storytelling.
Yeah, like really good storytelling. Now, granted, some of the moments that really thrilled me were partly because there's callback to characters who we've seen before.
Yeah.
So like Fennec
from Clone Wars or Mandalorian.
Right, from Mandalorian, from Clone Wars. Right. So if I hadn't seen Clone Wars or Mandalorian, maybe
it wouldn't be as thrilling as you have it now.
But I really, really just like the story. And one of the things I like about it is I really don't know where it's going.
It is not predictable.
It is not a predictable story. Like I can anticipate some, like one or two beats down the road, but I really don't know where the story is going to take these characters. And it's fun. It's thrilling. I love just being immersed in a story, not knowing where it's going, and just along for the ride.
I made predictions about how things would go.
Oh yeah, the kids and I talk.
I try not to spoil it for you guys with my.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was watching it for the first time, yeah, I was making predictions. I kind of saw where some things were going, but there's a lot of it where I did not see that. And they really do with the writing in it. They really keep it at a fairly sophisticated level. It is not going to just follow all of the expected beats that you expect to see in this kind of show.
Right. And I feel like there's definitely a lot tighter storytelling than Clone Wars and even than Rebels. Like it's
right.
It's much more focused. It's really this similar quality to The Mandalorian.
Right. You can see how their writing has improved over the years.
Right.
Their storytelling.
There's no wasted space. Yeah. Really. Even the comic bits.
Yes.
Are focused, they're sharp, they're tight, they're not, they don't draw out too long.
Right.
And like in one of the episodes today, we like switch to the point of view of like inside one of the clones' helmets, like right. His point of view. And that was like a really great moment where you're in his point of view, looking at the world from where he is and trying to kind of figure out what's going on with a very limited, like jerky, like as if like the
what's
camera...
it like to be a clone in that helmet?
Yeah, that was it was a brilliant moment of storytelling and really using like the point of view. And right. There's been some really great moments like that where, yeah, it's
you can tell
it's
like
sophisticated.
Rebels is better than Clone Wars. This is better than Rebels. You know that progression.
And it's making me really excited to see like. Other products like Book of Boba Fett. I'm really, yes. I first, when they first announced Book of Boba Fett, I'm like, oh, I guess that could be kind of cool. And now like, especially yeah. Getting to know some more of the characters, I'm thinking, how is this going to intersect? Where is this story going? How are they going to connect?
Again, this is what you have to look forward to. Book of Boba Fett, Mandalorian season 3, Ahsoka, the Obi-Wan series,
I'm really excited about Ahsoka.
Cassian Andor series. And then the other ones like that they mentioned, the Something Apprentice and the, what was that? I forget what it's called. The Acolyte, that's what it is. The Acolyte. And then the Rangers of the New Republic. I mean, what could all that be? I mean, it's just fascinating. It's going to be pretty. And Star Wars Visions actually starting soon, which is going to be interesting. That's anime style. So
I am not really a big anime style fan. So
I'm curious. We'll see how that goes.
Then the I've been watching the Mysterious Benedict Society with the kids too, which is fun, and it's really well done. The kids are saying to me, it's been ages since I read the book, but they're saying to me that they feel like the characters in the show are more rounded than the characters in the book, which is kind of an interesting reversal, because usually you expect like the book is more fleshed out. They say they feel like the story is being more fleshed out in the TV show.
Well, see, this goes back to what I have been saying for a while now, is I want to see books made into series, like limited series, instead of movies.
Yes.
When you turn a book into a movie, the movie has much more limited space to tell the story.
Whereas the series actually has more space than the book to tell the story.
Right.
In this case, and they're really using it to advantage. They're really good storytelling. So that's also worth checking out if you haven't yet checked out Mysterious Benedict. So if you haven't read the books, it's still worth checking out. Like, you can know nothing about the books.
I haven't read the books, and I find them fun. So we will continue to watch Marvel's What If. This week wasn't as good. Whereas the one with the Doctor Strange one was dark but compelling, this one was just bleak.
Oh my god!
Because it was zombies.
Zombie apocalypse, but with Marvel superheroes.
And kind of intentionally campy.
Yeah, I felt like it couldn't decide on a tone, but I think that on the whole, the tone was really much more comedic. Like, they were playing it for laughs a lot of the time.
It was like horror comedy.
And that's just not my thing.
Yeah.
There have been some zombie stories that I have been found compelling. This was not one of them. I just felt like it was like, let's watch the Marvel characters become zombies, because won't that be kind of cool?
Right.
And
it was done for shock effect, some of the things, yeah.
And I didn't feel like there was much of a storyline. It was just...
Well, it's a typical zombie storyline. We have to escape the zombies.
Right. But that was pretty much all that they did. It was just like, escape the zombies, and far too many people die and turn into zombies in the process.
Right.
Which is unsatisfying, because then at the end, like, the people who do survive, like, what have they got to look forward to? All their friends are dead. They're zombies.
Yeah. The world is all zombies.
It's just
all, yeah.
It was bleak.
Yeah.
But it was not the best effort in the series so far.
So then you mentioned a YouTube channel that you wanted to...
Oh, right. I didn't do a lot of watching, but I did. I am really addicted to the...
Costume reconstruction.
Yeah. historical costumes.
Yes.
And so I've watched... And so YouTube is, of course, the algorithm has figured me out. And so I stumbled upon getting dressed as a Jewish woman in the Middle Ages. The YouTuber's name is Snappy Dragon, and she does a whole bunch of different kinds of costuming stuff, but she's Jewish. And so she wanted to sort of explore what would Jews have been wearing in the Middle Ages. So she picked two particular times and places, England and Al-Andalus in the 14th century, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of went into the costume, but she went into a little bit of like sort of the history of like, who is a Jew? What's it like to be Jewish? Talking about sort of the diversity among Jews, but and the, some of the history, like what, you know, Jews being allowed in, invited into England by Richard the Lionheart, and then being expelled. And interesting things like talking about with the Jewish, the Mosaic law says that you can't mix fibers of different kinds. So you can't have a garment that's made with both wool and linen fibers, which in the Middle Ages, most of the costuming stuff is done, like even the wool fiber are sewn with linen thread. So she was like having trouble sourcing wool thread so that she could have correct clothes. It was just like, there was a lot of really interesting details. She's very outspoken in some ways. So there's a little bit of the modern social commentary as well, but it was really good. It was very interesting.
She has a video, a medieval Spanish Jew's dress, but it's cosplay, and it references the lines of El Rasan.
Ooh. Okay.
By Guy Gavriel Kay, a book you and I have both read.
I did not see that video, so I'm going to have to go back and watch that, because Lions of Al-Razan is one of my favorite fantasy novels.
So, yeah, it's from just 2 days ago. So,
and I was actually thinking about that when I was watching, because, like, the character in Lions of Al-Razan is another of those alt-history.
Sort of alt-history. It's like alternate world that is very much like ours.
Right. It's not really alt-history so much as fantasy, but with a strong historical parallel.
Right. They're not called Jews, but you know they're Jews. And they're not called Muslims, but you know they're Muslims. And it's essentially the story of El Cid.
Right. It's El Cid, but in an alternate fantasy world where it's not exactly the same, but it's similar.
There is kind of magic and stuff like that, too, yeah.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, got you off topic there. But Snappy Dragon is the thing. I'll put a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, so she's interesting. She's fun, worth checking out. Yep. I just really like to zone out to videos of people sewing sometimes. It's very soothing.
Yes. I like watching videos of people traveling in the woods and on you know, rivers and canoeing and things like that. I find that very soothing. And you like the sewing and stuff like that.
Right.
So let's move on to our last bit of discussion tonight. And we're going to talk about the gospel today, the readings for Mass today. And the theme was about the cross. It's continuing the suffering servant gospel that we had in the last few weeks.
Right.
And so the second reading was from James. It's the famous faith without works is dead. This is the bit that made Luther wanted to eject James from the canon.
Right. It did not fit very well with Luther's.
It didn't fit with his viewpoint.
Sola fide.
Yes. So it says, I really like the verse. It kind of made me sit up and think, you know, you have faith and I have you. Indeed, someone might say, sorry, you have faith and I have works. Demonstrate your faith to me without works, and I will demonstrate my faith to you from my works. You often hear the faith without works is dead line. But this, I really like this. Demonstrate your faith to me without works, and I will demonstrate my faith to you from my works. And that's the thing, is the key, and I think the key misunderstanding is this for some Protestants about Catholicism, is we're not saying we can earn salvation by our works.
We're saying our works are the demonstration of our faith.
Right. That
Which in practice, of course, Protestants also agree that, like, if you claim to have a faith and you're not actually practicing it, your works don't reflect it, then they would say, too, that your faith is dead. Like,
right. Although they would say that in practice and in the lived expression
right.
of their life, their Christian life. But the theology is often, no, you can't lose your salvation even if you stop doing the works.
Right.
Like, once saved, always saved. Which is not logical and doesn't make any sense.
But that's not how
not how the force works.
But that's not how most people actually live and practice their faith. Like,
right.
Every faithful Protestant I've met,
they know that you love your neighbor. You do the things that Jesus says in the end of the gospel about, you know, the
because Christ tells us to do these things. Right. Feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty.
Throw the sick in the street and, I don't know, somebody do something with the imprisoned. Visit the imprisoned.
Yes.
Clothe the naked.
Do those things.
Right, do those things. So I really like that verse. It's actually my favorite. I like that even more than the other verse. The other thing that with the gospel is this is the famous one where Jesus says, he asks the disciples, you know, they're walking on the road, who do the people say that I am? And they give him all the things, John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. And then he stops and says, but who do you say that I am? I really like when the priest or the deacon emphasizes that way, you know, okay, but who do you say that I am? So he's kind of turning it like, all right, that's what the people say, but what do you think? It would be weird if John or Andrew said, oh, we think you're John the Baptist.
Right, since they were John the Baptist's disciples before they followed Jesus, that would be odd.
How would that work, Peter? No, but he's Peter says you are the Christ, which means the Messiah, the Anointed One.
I liked Father Elias's take on this morning. Which
yes.
He started off by saying, you know, if your fringe suddenly stopped and said,
who am I?
Who am I? What's my name? You would say, that's a really weird question. We've been friends for a long time. Of course I know who you are. Why are you asking me this? And yet Jesus asks his disciples who've been his friends for and walking around with him for quite some time, who do you think that I am?
I think Jesus already kind of knew and was trying right. to elicit from them.
Well, sure. It's he's
say it. It's time to say it out loud, right. guys.
It's, you know, he's the rabbi. He's the teacher teaching through questions. It's the Socratic method, really.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is a master of it. And the like, okay, you have to like put it into words. And, you know, when I'm talking about the kids with something, they'll often say, I know it, but I just can't say it. But as a teacher, you know, if you can't explain it to somebody else, you don't really know it. There's something about putting it into words, about saying it or writing it, that it crystallizes what you know. And the struggle, sometimes it is a struggle to find the right words. Like, I know you're, you know, I can see this, like, with Jesus, like, I know you're special. I know you're something bigger and better, but what exactly is that?
Right. So the other thing about this gospel I really like is the fact that Peter goes from the heights. He's the one who says, you're the Christ. Good job, Peter. Well done. High five for Peter, everyone. Yes, Peter, good job, good job. And then Jesus tells him, oh, the Son of Man must suffer greatly. And Peter takes him aside, like, hey, now I'm the big man, right? You know, I'm the one who said you were the Christ. So let me call you aside, give you some of the what for. Hey, you know, this talk about dying and rising from the dead, that's kind of weird and kind of bumming everyone out. So you need to stop that, Jesus. Jesus turns and says, get behind me, Satan. Ow, Peter. Boom, deflated. That had to hurt.
Okay. Here, this gospel also, though, had another of those moments, which I still struggle with every time they come up, where Jesus says, don't tell anybody.
Yes, it's another don't tell them.
Why does Jesus keep telling people not to tell other people? Like, is it just,
I think in this
my
case,
time hasn't come? It's yeah. not time for you to tell. It's my job to decide when and where and who you tell?
Well, I think the idea is in this case, he's not doing reverse psychology on them. It's now's not the right time. Like, don't go running around telling everyone that I'm the Christ, because you'll mess up the whole timetable. You know, because what that would do is it would force the hands of the Pharisees and the Romans to do something about him prematurely.
And then the timeline wouldn't match up with, like,
right.
Passover.
Well, God's plan is such that it needs to occur in such a way, and that the things will be revealed. And he's telling them this now because he wants them to be able to talk about it after the resurrection, and that he wants them to know. Look, I'm telling you this now so because you're going to see things. And when the resurrection comes, you're going to know that I told you this was going to happen. So don't worry about it. You know, hold on to this. So that's why he tells him, look, I'm going to tell you this. This isn't for everyone yet, but I'm going to tell you this now because you need to know this now.
Right. But every time we come up on that, I'm like, just like, don't tell anyone.
Don't tell anyone. And then, you know, 2000 years later, they told everybody.
it's kind of. It's funny.
So he does tell them that whoever wishes to come after me must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Now, when we hear take up your cross, we think, you know, a spiritual moment. Oh, yes, take up the mission God has entrusted to me. But think of it from the disciples' point of view. The only cross they know of is that horrible torture device that the Romans have.
Follow me and take up your cross. And this is, of course, before Jesus has been crucified. So they don't like know.
They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know that there's a resurrection at the end of that.
I mean, that's just a very disturbing thing for him to say. And I do not know how they could have made any sense out of it and not just been like, what is he talking about? Like, I can just see them like sort of standing around in a huddle afterward going, do you understand what he means? Like, I'm take up guess, your cross?
I'm gonna
what?
Guess they did that a lot. Like when they stop for the night and Jesus rolls up in his bedroll and goes to sleep, that the other apostles are sitting around going, okay, let's compare notes. What did he say today? And what do you think he meant? I'm gonna guess that happened a lot. But you think about this, like whoever wishes to come after me must deny himself and in a 21st century context, say, sit in his electric chair and follow me. I mean, that would be pretty astonishing. So you got to kind of think of the way that they would have thought about it. But you had a nice way of talking to the kids about this reading today.
Well, yeah, because Father talked about like, and it's kind of a standard sort of thing, like talking about for us,
what are our crosses?
You know, is it poverty? Is it not having a job? The daily struggles of life that we can take up. And I was thinking, as a parent, how do we help our children to understand this theology in a way that they can live it out, like take up your cross? Because of course children's faith life isn't just sort of on hold until they're an adult and they can like finally become Christian. Like they are Christians now, they're baby Christians, but they're learning how, and they do have crosses in their lives. They're small perhaps compared to like mine, but in their world it's just as big and just as dramatic. I don't think as a child, I really thought of the various things that I suffered as crosses or knew what to do with this crosses, idea of take up your cross.
Not just suffering, but crosses that you could take up and that could be a way of serving God, offering up those sufferings for others, for graces.
Yeah, it's I'm still kind of wrestling with how to help kids, I guess, encounter that gospel verse, that idea more deeply, more meaningfully. Like, is this something that's just for adults, or is this something that kids can partake in? I mean,
the
obviously,
theology of the cross for kids would be an interesting.
Right. I mean, obviously, you know, you hear stories of like saintly children who like suffer cancer or suffer martyrdom even.
Like
and
the Cristeros there. Yeah.
Right. We just finished reading about St. Jose Sanchez del Rio, who was a 14 or 15 year old martyr in Mexico. I mean, clearly he's taking up his cross. And yet you think he must have had a deep prayer life, spiritual life up to that point in order to be able to embrace that at that young age. Like, so how do we as parents help our children to see their daily sufferings and trials and tribulations and the chores that they don't want to do? How do you see them in the light of the cross? I'm still not sure exactly how to do that, but it's
right.
It's something to kind of think about, like how to bring that to their awareness, to help them to think about it, meditate on that, and live it.
Yeah. If anybody knows of any resources in this area, I would love to hear about them, but it's...
Are there?
Yeah, if there are any. But it's an interesting... Like, there are plenty of young people who suffered greatly, like saints, like Blessed Carlo Acutis, who offered up his sufferings from cancer.
I mean, and of course we have, like, Saint Therese, who...
Suffered in small ways.
She tried to, even as a child, find small ways to suffer for God. Make little sacrifices for him.
But it's not even about the little seeking out little sacrifices, but also just the sufferings you deal with as not sufferings, that seems grandiose, but the difficulties.
Right.
You know, how seeing those in light of the cross.
Our small little trials and... Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of times there's sort of this pat, like, offer it up, but
Yeah,
I feel like
it can be trite.
I've encountered that phrase in ways that didn't feel helpful to me. As like, what does that mean, and how do I do that? Like, what's
it? Sometimes that comes across as stop complaining,
right? And what's my action plan if I'm going to offer up my suffering? Like, what does that mean? How do I do that? What's the means? What's the technique? What are the steps?
What is offering up your suffering look like?
Right. Is it just saying, God, I'm offering up my suffering? Like, just saying that? Is that enough?
Is it putting on a happy face? good question.
I feel like we don't talk about this enough. Like, we're afraid of the cross, and we don't really talk about...
There are writings. It's like St. John of the Cross and right. St. Teresa of Avila. But because they are writing in a different era, a different age, a different cultural milieu, it's harder to apply that. I wish there were more writings that help you apply it to today, to the current situations in your daily life. Not living in a monastery, but, you know, living in a family home in a suburb of, you know, of a city, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I feel like oftentimes the people who have had time to think and write are, well, monastics, because, well, obviously they do have.
Right. Or theologians, or, you know, people whose job it is to write this stuff. Or so much of it is very happy clappy, kind of trite. It's very surface. I mean, I can't think of anybody I want to name in that, but there's a lot of stuff out there that is very shallow sort of approach to this topic too. So yeah, I think it's an area that needs to be developed of spiritual writing, spiritual thinking on these things. All right, I think we should wrap things up there. All right. On that note. We would like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including John S., Ricky S., Cher J., Zoran U., and Ramona F. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What did you think of our discussion? If you have any advice or commentary, we'd love to hear from you at sqpn.com/bets, that's B-E-T-T-S, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And of course, I'll have links to everything from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com. Be sure to join the StarQuest fan club by texting StarQuest to 66866, that's StarQuest to 66866. That'll get you the inside scoop on everything that's going on at StarQuest. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.